Society is having trouble keeping up with the pace of technology. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with an author and expert about how the digital era could empower a more authoritarian political world. That conversation starts now.
Hello, and thanks for listening, as always. Okay, I'm going to shorten my intro here so we can air as much of this next interview as possible. Our guest is a writer, reporter, and blogger about tech, and he's based in the UK, but of course tech is universal, and so his take on how the people, writ large, are turning on tech. Going further, our author sees how we can use social networks to insulate ourselves like this.
The ability of each of us to create our own information worlds, our own information universes, is incredibly damaging for the ability of people to sort of listen to each other and compromise.
And that very confirmation bias is a direct, demonstrable, and palpable threat to democracy as we know it. Keep in mind, democracy was developed in a very analog time. That's just not the world today. Here we go.
Jamie Bartlett, I am the author of the book The People Versus Tech. I also write a blog in the UK on technology for The Spectator magazine.
And the subtitle for the book, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. How is the Internet killing democracy in a macro way?
Well, the way I see it, it's a big sort of generational challenge that we had this representative democracy that was built up over several decades, but in an analog age, you know, we had certain pillars that I think people often forget that make democracy actually work. It's not just about individual freedom. It's also a system of government and order and control. And I look at these different pillars, whether that's informed citizens that want to compromise and have a shared sense of reality, whether it's elections that people consider to be free and fair, a vibrant press, a strong middle class, a police force that can actually do its job. These are parts of a democracy that as well. And each of those, I think, are being kind of washed away almost by this brand new technology. So we have a sort of digital tech which is decentralized, exponentially improving, it's hard to control, it doesn't respect borders. And as a result, I think many of the stories that we've heard over the last few weeks are essentially an expression of that clashing of two different systems, new and old.
Are we seeing, Jamie, the disintegration of shared common truths? And that is one of the pillars you're talking about?
Exactly. The sort of the ability of each of us to create our own information worlds, our own information universes, is incredibly damaging for the ability of people to sort of listen to each other and compromise. And this isn't just about creating an echo chamber of like-minded people. It's also about the way that we clash with our opponents online. The liberal theory is that you speak with people with whom you disagree and you come to some kind of consensus or an understanding. Whereas when you're discussing things online, it gets very tribal, it gets very angry, there's not much rationality, it's all emotional. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why politics has become like measurably and demonstrably more tribal. And when politics is tribal, i.e. you're on my team or you're not on my team, the ability to compromise gets almost impossible. And unfortunately, that seems to be where we're heading. And I think that is digital tech, because it's what happens when you're overwhelmed with information.
Jamie, aren't we dealing with an unintended consequence here? I mean, because if we think about social networking, Twitter and Facebook specifically, when they come up, it seems that that's not the way it started. It didn't, you know, at Biz, you know, Biz Stone didn't help start Twitter just so he could rant liberally about something else. And he doesn't do that, of course. I'm using it as an example. But that's not how we started on Twitter. Twitter was a news feed for a long time, right? I mean, and Facebook was kind of like finding your ex-girlfriend from high school and trolling, you know, that kind of thing. But it was just like, it was a little more benign. But now it's almost been weaponized. Is that what you're seeing?
That is definitely part of it, you know. I mean, to me, Marshall McLuhan was right back in the 1960s when he said the arrival of electronic technology would turn us into more emotional tribal creatures. But it wasn't on purpose. No one designed it to be like that. No one really wanted it to be like that. People often make the mistake here of imagining that there's just a handful of evil capitalists and they're all, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and the rest, they're all out to undermine democracy. I don't think they are. I think they're Democrats. I just think they're almost as surprised by what's happening as everybody else. And, of course, a key moment was 7 or 8 years ago when the big tech firms realized that the way to monetize their services was, of course, to serve up adverts. And that created an entirely new dynamic, which traded on attention and distraction and serving you up things that you'd click on. And that was a pivotal moment in the kind of change to this new culture.
You are absolutely right. Look, I think of it like this. Technology in the 20th century basically beat the Nazis and stopped World War II. It created a decrease in the income gap and the wealth gap. It created so many things. In the 21st century, our technology is basically selling us more Nissans.
And doing it incredibly effectively. And you know, the funny thing about it is that I think a lot of people, maybe foolishly, were completely unconcerned by this when it was selling Nissans. Suddenly, we've realized, particularly in the last presidential election, that it's also being used to sell us politics and that it can be used by Russian trolls and Russian bots to try to sway public opinion. And I think that's one of the reasons why you've had this sudden, like very widespread outpouring of anger and frustration about this, even though in truth, we know it's been happening for quite a long time, but now it's touching politics. Everyone is suddenly rather scared about it.
Now, first, I want to thank you for saying Nissan and not Nissan, because I know you're calling from the UK.
I tried. I did try. Yeah, I did it for your listeners.
Second is, okay, you're in the UK and you recently went through a political, let's say, spike of interest or disinterest. We also here in America went through one in the presidential election. And that has to do with Facebook somewhat, at least the dissemination of digital data. What did you see and hear coming out of the testimony from CEO Mark Zuckerberg a couple of weeks ago?
Well, the first, I think, obvious thing was this was Mr. Zuckerberg trying to reassure investors that he's got this under control. But also, as I read it, it was him trying to convince the senators, especially, that we don't really want more regulation. We're okay. We can handle this. All the problems you're worried about, we can deal. We are a responsible company now. We've realized we've made mistakes. That, to me, is really the big question here. Do the politicians, are they sufficiently confident that Facebook and the other big tech firms can be trusted to respond to the worries that people have about disinformation, the constant collection of personal data? And so you may have noticed, I mean, I watched 5 hours of this stuff. I mean, it was a real marathon slog, wasn't it? But you may have noticed Mark Zuckerberg kept responding with, I'll get my team on this. My team will be back in touch with you. So I imagine for the last couple of weeks, his team has been hard at work trying to get the detail of the sort of solutions that they're proposing. But here's the other thing. You must have noticed that disconnect between Mark Zuckerberg's obvious knowledge about how the tech worked and how some of the senators and congresspeople understood how the tech worked.
Oh, absolutely.
And at times, it was pretty abysmal. I don't expect every politician to be a computer scientist. Of course not. That would be terrible, by the way.
Yes.
But some basic knowledge of how the internet works is pretty important if you're going to hold these people to account.
Yeah, I totally agree. When I was watching it, I thought that the staffers who were preparing the questions for the senators should have been the ones asking the questions because they would have the facility to ask a follow-up question. You know what I mean? So, I mean,
you really could tell, couldn't you, when they asked a question and didn't have a follow-up because they didn't really understand what the question was. And I thought, no, this is such a wasted opportunity.
I know. Jamie, I want to stay here just for a second. I do want to get back to the book, The People Versus Tech. We're speaking with Jamie Bartlett, the author of The People Versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. That's the important part. We're going to get back to that in just a second. But back to Facebook. Two things I noticed, too, and I want to see if I can get some confirmation bias from you. One was Mark Zuckerberg said that people use 8 social apps a day to stay connected. What he failed to say was Facebook owns 4 of those. Facebook, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and Instagram. And the 5th one was email. Then the second thing I noticed, too, was he positioned himself as key to national security when answering a question about China. I found that to be something that was really, really important, and that might be something that helps him stave off regulation for now. Did you find any other little tidbits that stood out for you?
Both of those are really important, and I think they speak to the nature and the power of the modern monopoly. It's not like the olden ones. And one of the senators was talking about Fords and Chevys, and you could have one and buy another one. But the modern digital monopoly is not the same anymore. Like, as you've said, they own lots of different companies. It's about the sort of nature of how much power is in the hands of these companies, especially with our sort of political public space. And I think you're right. The monopoly in China is so important because as this technology gets powerful, more powerful, and AI gets more powerful, national security, to an increasing extent, I think, will depend on who has the best tech. And the nature of modern technology is that the more tech you have, the more data you have, the better tech you can build. This is why Google is now something of a natural monopoly. If you split it up, it would be less good. And Mark Zuckerberg knows that. I'm sure the NSA knows that. Yeah. So this is so important. And most people, I'm glad you picked it up because most people miss that. I thought another interesting thing was he hinted at the possibility that one day some of Facebook might be paid for.
Yes.
He didn't rule it out. He said there'll always be a free service, but some of it might be paid for. And I think all the tech firms right now are thinking, maybe this ad model that we've been using for the last decade is unsustainable in the long run. The regulations will come in. People will start downloading more ad blockers. People will start not clicking because they're fed up with it. And we need another way of making money. Exactly what that's going to be, to be discussed. Maybe it will be paid for. Maybe it'll be something else. Maybe Facebook can mine Bitcoin. Who knows? But I thought that was a really interesting revelation I hadn't heard him say before.
I think that's an excellent takeaway. I think that you're looking at in the right direction. I think the Spotify model might be something that these tech companies look at moving forward with the subscription service.
Yeah.
And then the add-on. I know you probably saw that Spotify and Hulu are now offering a combined package here in the United States. I think it's coming to the rest of the world sometime later this year. Last point on that I'd like to make, and you're welcome to follow up, is Facebook is an umbrella brand, and it needs to be considered as such. Amazon is an umbrella brand. Google is an umbrella brand under Alphabet, but nobody calls it Alphabet. They call it Google. These things need to be looked at a little bit harsher. I wish, like you, that we could have gone deeper during this testimony, because as Zuckerberg goes, a lot of Silicon Valley goes too.
Yeah, exactly. And when he said this quite strange line, he said, well, it certainly doesn't feel like a monopoly to me. You know, I was like, well, it does feel like a monopoly to me. So how do we resolve this one?
Right.
The truth, it's a new modern monopoly. It's not like the old ones. We've got to kind of get out of the mindset of it's all about competition. And when prices go up, that's bad. And that's when we know a monopoly is a problem. It's not like that anymore. These companies push prices down.
Exactly.
They're like the opposite. It's very strange.
These antitrust laws that we had coming out of World War II were to protect the consumer pricing, basically. Now we are using it to stamp down competition in the marketplace because these tech giants are able to gobble up everything around them.
Yeah, exactly. And we have to desperately figure out, some bigger brains than me, exactly what we do about the new tech giants. It's a new definition of monopoly. It's going to be something to do with data and market share and cross-platform control. Facebook buying Instagram and WhatsApp was something that maybe under a new model, your antitrust law would have prevented.
Let's talk about your book a little bit more, How the Internet is Killing Democracy. We talk a little bit about Brexit, a little bit about the election of Donald Trump and the pushback from the populace, if you will. But part of your subtitle is so compelling. How do we save it? Is there really a way to save it? Can we really pull back from this brink that we've pushed ourselves toward?
I see democracy as a multi, sort of a general use technology in a way. Democracy can reshape and reform. It was very different in ancient Greece to the way that it was under your representative system, really, I mean, that the founding fathers designed. And then when mass parties came along, it changed again. And it's kind of got a bit stuck. It hasn't really changed much for a century. So democracy is going to have to change somehow. So it's more in tune with our modern technology. So there are going to be ways, I think, to save it. But to me, you've got to identify how might it kind of collapse? What's the dystopia that we're heading for? And some people say, oh, it's a stateless dystopia of cryptocurrencies and powerless governments. And others say, no, we'll have full luxury automated communism and there'll be incredibly high levels of productivity and people will be able to be given free money to live happily. And I think that the most likely is that we drift slowly into this kind of easy techno-authoritarianism, where governments become more and more authoritarian just to maintain control and order, because governments become weaker and weaker as a result of modern technology. So the people demand more authoritarian systems to keep society ticking over. And to me, that's the dystopia we're heading towards. And weirdly, it might make us richer, but it probably won't make us any freer. So if you identify that as the dystopia, I think, yeah, there are some things that we can do. And I suggest sort of 20 of them that I think might help.
Yes. You said richer, less free. What about safe? Are we going to be safer?
The majority of crime that takes place now is online. Certainly in the UK, the majority of crime in the UK is now online crime. Less than 0.25% of online crime in the UK results in a prosecution. This is anarchy. I mean, this isn't working.
Yeah.
But nobody's saying that. The police in all developed economies are really struggling to keep on top of this. And so at the moment, we are heading to somewhere that we're not going to be safe. And think about the possible crimes of the future. I mean, what happens when you have your entire home is connected up and on the great Internet of Things, and people can hack into your home heating system and your home devices and to your car and to your children's toys? And what happens when powerful artificial intelligence is able to automatically work out all the weaknesses in a device and hack into it, or there's drones that... I mean, the possibilities of a small number of people causing very big trouble is getting bigger and bigger. And so we're heading somewhere that I think we're going to be less safe. And this is why the thing that worries me is that we will demand that the police and the National Security Agency and law enforcement agencies have more and more and more powers to keep us safe, even at the cost of our own freedom.
Right.
So rather than setting us free, my argument is that digital technology might end up enslaving us, which is the exact opposite of what we all hoped for.
Exactly. The internet was built to help us be free, right? I mean,
I'm not saying that people don't want that. People wanted it to help us to be free. It's just weirdly not worked out quite that way.
You know, Anil Dash is a name you may know, former Silicon Valley. He now lives in New York and he starts a lot of companies. He said just recently that when we say we want to change the world, we have to own it when we do. And that's what Mark Zuckerberg and others have failed to do so far. We need a conscience to go around our freedoms that we are building on the internet. Is that a fair take from what kind of you said and what Anil is saying too?
Yeah, I think that's really good. I mean, Stanley Baldwin, a prime minister in the UK in 1931, was talking about powerful press barons. And he said, these are people who have power without responsibility. And that, of course, is that's been part of the problem, hasn't it?
Yeah.
We have all this power, these companies, and they're changing things, but with what responsibility? I mean, they just say that we're platforms, it's not our problem. So I think that there's definitely... Maybe we're beginning to see the beginnings, though, of a bit more of a grown-up attitude towards this. Remember, so I have a theory, which is that, and I know this is sounds a bit odd, a lot of these young tech guys, and it's nearly always tech guys, you know, they started these companies in their 20s, and now they're old enough to have children, and they're suddenly looking at their kids on their devices and thinking, what on earth have we wrought onto the world? What have we created? What is it doing to the future generations? And that's just kind of them getting a bit older and realizing we are perhaps responsible after all.
I'm totally with you, because the average aged employee at Facebook is 28. There is no possible way they have the context to understand how important a free press is to democracy and so forth and so on. It's not just about being able to say whatever you want on any platform you want. It's being able to own that responsibly as well. Jamie, thank you so much for your time. Let's please talk again soon.
Jason, thank you for having me.
That was Jamie Bartlett. He is the author of The People Versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. There's an extended, uninterrupted version of this interview on our podcast. Just search for Techonomics where you pull down your podcasts, including iTunes, where there's a shiny subscribe button there, too. For links to Jamie's books, plural, and other discussions about democracy in the digital age, please check out the show story for this week. It lives at KGORadio.com. Coming up after the break, more change. I hear if we're flexible, it keeps us young. This time, the change will come from the workplace.
Highly engaged workforces have 2 times higher stock market returns, which is fantastic. Lower turnover and more innovation, which in this fast-paced world is absolutely critical.
That's next. So please stick around. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.